Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today. So I am 54 years old, and by all accounts, a tall steeple pastor. I am in my 22nd year at Wilshire in Dallas, and this is the time of life when I am supposed to be asking the question of how I am moving from success to significance. Do you know that time of life or that phrase? So this whole idea about whether we're to change the world as a church strikes me as an individual because I feel as though I'm now asking the question, what significance has my life had? Am I changing the world? Have I been an influence in some way? And the problem I think I have with this question personally is, how would you ever know the answer? You know, really. I mean, what would be a mark that you have mattered? I'm thinking maybe I got invited here to speak today, to follow Will Willimon, to respond to, there's all sorts of these questions. And so, I think every time we do strategic planning at our church, the key question and the big problem we have is always one of metrics. That is, how are we going to measure how we're doing? I think that's a fundamental problem for the church, because almost always when we do strategic planning, we use some business model of doing it, and then we have to come back and say, how will we know we've succeeded? And the church is kind of slippery about that, I think, if you're being true to what you're doing. So I guess it was 1994 that we initiated another strategic plan at our church. And part of this entailed the commission of the pastor to write a mission statement for us. I loved listening to this dialogue, this exchange about the mission statement. So I came up with this mission statement, which I thought was sublime. You be the judge. The Wilshire mission is to build a community of faith shaped by the Spirit of Jesus Christ. I found that fairly unobjectionable in the way I phrased it, but because I wrote it, I probably would. And I didn't get too much pushback about it, interestingly enough. I just think most people didn't have a sense of what it meant. And I said, that's okay, because we'll work that out over time. We'll figure that out, because the point of the mission statement being written the way it was that we don't actually know exactly what that will mean, because the Spirit of Jesus Christ is supposed to be working on us and through us, and whatever that turns out to be is what we'll be. Well, you know, some people came up and said, but shouldn't there be evangelism in there? You know, because we're Baptist. And winning the world for Christ, or missions, because missions is the hallmark of being Baptist. And again, you know, I just thought, well, this sentence seems unobjectionable. Let's just stay with this. But I quickly found we had another problem with it, and that is every time people started writing it, they would use a small s instead of a capital S for the Spirit of Jesus Christ. And therein is another slippery moment, slippery part, right? Because the minute you turn the Holy Spirit into the Spirit of, you move from something with a very strong God orientation to something more like an esprit de corps, something more like what we decide Jesus' kind of important ideas are. And so we become another affinity group that is gathered around common purposes as a church. And this is something that all of us in churches fight all the time, isn't it? I mean, are we really just a group of people who have a lot in common and like being together? And is that what our church is? I know that as the pastor of our church, we have to make sure we have really good children's ministries, because, you know, you'll never have young adults if you don't have great children's ministries. But what does having a great children's ministry mean? And the next thing is, well, then we need to paint Noah's Ark on the walls because that'll entertain them, and we need to have a youth ministry with a really great guitar player, and we need to have, because they have to want to come to church because they'll be happy if they do and entertained. Our youth minister recently had to have that conversation with a parent, and he said, "But it's not my job to entertain your kids." Aren't they entertained all day long, every day, and in every way? Aren't they supposed to learn more about what it means to be a Christian and to have some moments of some depth and reflection about the Christian life when they come to the one place that is assigned this duty? But that's hard to break through, isn't it, in our culture? We're always wrestling with people who would want to co-opt what our church is supposed to be and supposed to do in order to achieve other ends for it. So therefore, to set our kids up well in the world, to keep them from drugs and sex, and maybe, you know, to make them successful in school and in other enterprises. Do our kids go on these wonderful mission trips to the Dominican Republic and Kenya and places like this because of their passion for wanting to be the presence of Christ in the world, or because that's going to look really good on a college application? Which is it? You know, well, our parents, I think, are maybe sometimes equally as concerned with how this will work with their developing resume as their developing spiritual life and the character that they are forming. And this is problematic. It's really difficult. And then we have, you know, the question of whether the church is on the right or wrong side of things politically. I don't know if you're a pastor, but if you are, you probably deal with this as well as I, and that is, you have people in the congregation who are almost all, their ears are trained to listen for party and partisan lines. And so when they come to church, they have figured that they have found the right people who are like them, and therefore the preacher has to, well, they have to listen carefully to make sure that they're still in the right place all the time. So I had an email not long ago from a guy in our church who said that he was talking to some other members who had previously been concerned but were delighted to see that I had been quoting some more conservative Republican people and the Wall Street Journal, actually, recently, and that they were encouraged about the life of our church. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? And it's likely, because we have a Democratic president now, that I would be quoting that side, because previously I was quoting the New York Times and Democrats. It's sort of the nature of our work that you kind of rub a little bit, you know, depending upon where things are. But the very fact that their ears are so tuned to this sort of political rhetoric, and the assumption is we are there to serve some greater ideology that they have committed themselves to before they came to church. You see, that's what's going on here. It reminds me of when Clinton was running for president. You remember James Carville kept telling him over and over and over again, just say this to yourself. Every time you have a question in your mind about this, just keep reminding yourself, it's the economy, stupid. Now, I love politics because I love sports. And I think it's a wonderful game, and I follow it closely and all of that, but I don't really think, sometimes when we're talking about how politics is what's really behind, I really think it's economics. I mean, underneath the politics, almost every political decision seems to be economically driven, and that seems to have mostly to do with self-interest, and that seems mostly not to be what the gospel is about. And so I sometimes have to feel like, as a pastor, I keep standing up, looking out at the congregation, and I want to say to myself, it's not the economy, stupid. It's not the economy, stupid. This is part of the problem we have is we have to keep working on ourselves to remain somehow moored to what it is we really do and who it is we really are. We run this pastoral residency program, and four of our residents are here today, and I'm delighted about that. It's a beautiful and wonderful thing. But I had someone come up to me recently who recognized that it seems our church is becoming an anomaly in terms of its style and approach to worship and organizing itself and that kind of thing. And this person said, aren't you a little bit concerned that you're training pastors for churches that will no longer exist? And I asked them, you know, well, what does that mean? You know, well, your kind of church, well, we don't have, like, screens, you know, and we have a pipe organ. Thank you for that, by the way. And not that those things matter most, but, I mean, you know, we don't cast about to ask the question first, what does everybody else want us to do and be? And so we try to form our life around the way we think the liturgical season and the gospel and the, you know, these things would inform us. And my hope is that the wonderful thing about this program is these young folks are going to go out and be pastors of churches, and I don't know whether we will have been successful or not. I don't know whether they will be successful or not. But the point really isn't that, is it? I mean, the point is whether we'll be faithful presence in the world, whether they will be, and what God will do with that is what God will do with that. I'll close with this. I have a movie recommendation for you. The most profound movie I've seen recently is called Of Gods and Men. And it's the story of the monks of Tiberine in Algeria. I think it beautifully symbolizes what we're called to do and be. In 1996, seven monks were taken hostage and never heard from again. A Trappist monastery in Tiberine, just south of Algiers in Algeria. And they were a faithful bunch that served their entirely Muslim community there in Algeria. Their prior Christian, Deschers, wrote a letter sometime before they were taken hostage, sensing the impending doom of their group. They had had to make decisions together about whether they would leave or stay based upon the terrorist threats of an extremist Muslim group that had come into that community. And they had been there for a long time, and part of the beauty of this is the way that they prayed and thought and worked out their differences about whether to stay or go and how they chose to stay. This letter beautifully depicts, I think, our Christian calling of faithful presence. Let me read it. If the day comes, and it could be today, that I am a victim of the terrorism that seems to be engulfing all foreigners living in Algeria, I would like my community, my church, and my family to remember that I have dedicated my life to God and Algeria. That they accept that the Lord of all life was not a stranger to this savage kind of departure. That they may pray for me, wondering how I found myself worthy of such a sacrifice. That they link in their memory this death of mine with all the other deaths equally violent but forgotten in their anonymity. My life is not worth more than any other, not less, not more. Nor am I an innocent child. I have lived long enough to know that I, too, am an accomplice of the evil that seems to prevail in the world around, even that which might lash out blindly at me. If the moment comes, I would hope to have the presence of mind and the time to ask for God's pardon and for that of my fellow man, and at the same time to pardon in all sincerity him who would attack me. I would not welcome such a death. It is important for me to say this. I do not see how I could rejoice when this people whom I love will be accused indiscriminately of my death. The price is too high, this so-called grace of the martyr, if I owe it to an Algerian who kills me in the name of what he thinks is Islam. I know the contempt that some people have for the Algerians as a whole. I also know the caricatures of Islam that a certain Islamist ideology promotes. It's too easy for such people to dismiss in good conscience this religion as something hateful by associating it with violent extremists. For me, Algeria and Islam are quite different from the community held, commonly held opinion. They are body and soul. I have said enough, I believe, about all the good things I have received here, finding so often the meaning of the Gospels running like some gold thread through my life, which began first at my mother's knee, my very first church here in Algeria, where I learned respect for the Muslims. Obviously, my death will justify the opinion of all those who dismissed me as naive or idealistic. Let him tell us what he thinks now. But such people should know that my death will satisfy my most burning curiosity. At last, I will be able, if God pleases, to see the children of Islam as he sees them, illuminated in the glory of Christ, sharing in the gift of God's passion and of the Spirit, whose secret joy will always be to bring forth our common humanity amidst our differences. I give thanks to God for this life, completely mine, yet completely theirs too. To God, who wanted it for joy against and in spite of all odds, in this thank you, which says everything about my life, I include you, my friends past and present, and those friends who will be here at the side of my mother and father, of my sisters and brothers. Thank you a thousandfold. And to you too, my friend of the last moment, who will not know what you are doing. Yes, for you too, I wish this thank you, this adieu, whose image is in you also, that we may meet in heaven like happy thieves, if it pleases God, our common Father. Amen. Inshallah.